Senator Elton, and myself, Chair Dyson. We may be joined at other times by some other folks. We do not have a quorum, or do we? I guess we...
Yeah, we do.
Three or five.
Three or five.
Yeah, okay. We do have a quorum. And the agenda for today's meeting is to hear from Donna from the U.S. Department of Education. As I understand it, you are the lead person for No Child Left Behind in the whole nation? Is that correct?
Not quite, for Alaska, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
All the important parts of it. And Senator Wilken is presenting a bill before CNRA, and many of us are very interested in a meeting that's going on, joint resources on taxation of the oil industry. So please don't take my colleagues not being here as a lack of interest. We're all playing triage today, and in fact, I'm supposed to be at three places concurrently. I'm chosen wisely. So what we're going to do is Ms. Foxley will make a presentation, tell us what's going on with No Child Left Behind and Alaska's interaction with it. We have somebody here from the Department of Education, and we will have lots of time to ask and answer all the questions I think that we have. I may get a phone call to show up at Ledge Council, and if so, I'll hand the gavel over to my friend Senator Elton. All right, please proceed. Thank you for being with us and helping us.
The first topic of No Child Left Behind that I would like to cover is the highly qualified teacher piece. Alaska is challenged in this area because of some of its extreme rural schools, and what we would like to encourage from Alaska and the department, as well as districts, is to look outside the box when it comes to meeting the needs of highly qualified teachers. We are looking for innovative, outside-the-box solutions. One of the things that we brought up is telecommuting a highly qualified teacher into a classroom, and then having the teacher on the ground be the support for that delivery. Possibly doing videotaping so that you don't have to worry about satellite feeds or weather disturbances, and then coordinating schedules, but different propositions of achieving the same end, delivering the highly qualified teacher there, and then utilizing the staff that is on hand as a support mechanism for those areas. So those are some of the things that I would encourage creative thinking about. We're really solution driven. There's a lot of regulation and guidelines, but we are constantly looking for a way to get to the goal with some flexibility added in. And also, I will admit readily that at the time we were discussing, not we, the Congress was discussing No Child Left Behind, they were much more focused on the lower 48. And even now, there are those who think they understand what it means to be a rural community. I just popped in from Barrow, and I've been to Tulalip and a few other places. And my grandmother was born and raised Skagway back in 1894, when there were still no roads. And I'm hoping that I can continue to communicate with the new secretary, Secretary Spellings, on board, that rural Alaska is unlike anything else in the lower 48. You may not have a road, you may not have electricity, you may not have plumbing, you may not have a sidewalk, you may have a lean-to. Savunga was one where, when Secretary Page won, he was very, I've been trying to explain, very impressed at what it took to get from point A to point B. And that there are reasons some things are challenges. So we're recognizing now that No Child Left Behind has gone on for the period of time it has, and the states have been putting the tools in place to meet the goal and meet the criteria. Now we're hoping to look state by state and work with the states individually on what it is that gives them the challenges, where they're having their successes, and then look at what is needed for the individual state to still hold the standard of the bar in place, but possibly take a different route. It'd be like asking somebody, telling somebody in DC, which I have 100 times, that you cannot drive from Juneau to Anchorage, but you can get there. You can fly, you can hop on a barge. There are alternatives, and the goal is still the same. The standards are still the same. So we want to know, instead of, we cannot, and I do not hear that from my Alaskan partners, if anything, is we can do this. We just have to do it with a little more creativity. So that's what I'm anxious to hear and carry back, is what are the creative solutions? Are they doable? And how can we make this work for Alaska?
Excuse me. For the record, Senator Green joined us about 28 minutes to the hour. Thank you.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Don. How do you want to do this? Do we wait till the end of the presentation, or as each element is done, do you
okay.
want questions?
Yeah. Which do you prefer?
It would probably be easier so that I cover each topic to do that, and then absolutely
That's fine.
Okay. Right. But you're not going to go all the way through it. You're going to go subject by subject and then pause for our questions.
Well, I thought I'd do highly qualified. If you don't mind, I go through. I have five separate things, but then we can go back and I'll say, okay, do we have questions on highly? Because they may some things may be answered as I go along.
All right. All right. And Senator Green, I may be called away for something I've got up in Ledger Council. I'll hand the gavel to you if you don't mind. Please continue.
Sorry, thank you, sir. One other piece that the state is working on, and I know the department is the written policy for the funds that are not used that are allowed to carry over or reallocation, and that has to be in written form, and they are in the process.
Donna, for the record, would you state your name and your official title, please?
Is Donna Foxley. I'm the Secretary's Regional Representative for the United States Department of Education, Region 10, representing Alaska, Oregon, Washington, Idaho.
Continue.
Thank you. So that pretty much covers my initial on the highly qualified teacher, and we do recognize that there are unique challenges to Alaska, and yet that if anybody can do this, Alaska, and the determination of independent is fully capable of finding solutions. Right. We have also, as of December, announced a 2% special needs assessment. That was something that states were sharing with us, that it would enable them to improve how they measure the achievement of students with disabilities. So we now have adopted the following. States may develop modified achievement standards and give assessments to qualified students based on those standards. So we now have, instead of at a 1%, it's 2%, and it's not of the special needs children, it's of the entire population. So if you have 1,000 students, 2% of 1,000, not 2% of whatever the special needs group is, to recognize that. States may include the proficient scores from the modified assessments in determining the AYP. It's capped at 2%, so you cannot go past that. But if it's a modified assessment and it's not to grade level, but it is appropriate for the child and the child achieves what the IEP and everyone believes is appropriate, that counts if it's their proficiency level as proficient. Mm-hmm. So that will help. The proposed regulations are designed to meet the needs of students with disabilities who may not reach grade level within the same time frame as their peers, but who can make significant strides given the right instruction. They also contain key criteria to protect students with disabilities from being inappropriately assessed against modified achievement standards. So the idea is, again, to deliver to the individual child the very best instructional methods and practices, and so that whatever the proficiency level that is determined, that child is not lost in the system. But, and I will tell you from personal experience, I have worked with adult special needs for over 17 to 18 years. And the difference between those that came from the institutions where they were never educated and the two that were raised by parents who were teachers is astronomical. They read, they write. We all have learned to sign to a minimum, so that sometimes the words are hard to pronounce and or just aren't going to happen. They can sign. There are so many ways to tap into their special gifts that they have to operate or offer us as we operate within the system. They make you stop and give you the gift of looking through different lenses, and that's very precious. We have on draft regulations coming out. Now, Thursday, December 15th is when it's proposed in the Federal Register. We've got 75 days after that publication, so 75 days from Thursday, December 15th, to get online and with your constituency and with your opinions, put your input in on what you think that should look like. And I have sent that out, and I also sent it up to Alaska. And please take the time to give us your input, to represent the people who you represent and their concerns and their desires for what they want for their children. During that time, it's open. The decision is not set. And they do listen, and they do want to hear. What they want to hear is your solutions, your ideas, so that we are addressing the needs of these children. So that's the 2%, and I would definitely encourage you to share. On the paper that I gave you, the Raising Achievement of Students with Disabilities, you have two of them, but one has December 2005 right under it. The department invites right here, it has the website, and you can go into it and get the information and fire it off, and please participate. All right, growth models, flex and accountability. We are now looking at up to 10 states proposing and being accepted. And as many states can propose as they want, that doesn't mean they will have the tools necessarily to do so, utilizing a growth model for AYP. Now, the standards and the accountability will stay the same. But what we're looking is that states show results, follow the requirements of No Child Left Behind, that they're in that mode, they're moving forward, and this is one of the new tools we're hoping they will be able to utilize to meet the requirements. Growth models do this specifically. They give schools credit for student improvement over time by tracking individual student achievement year to year. So it's child A, next year, child A, as they move through the system and how they are progressing with the goal to get them to standards. One of the approaches that states have repeatedly, and all my states except one, because they don't have the data in place, have asked, could we see a growth model? Will they consider a growth model? Well, up to 10 will be considered and put out as a possibility. I would encourage you to make your voice heard at the department, et cetera, that this is something I know Alaska is very interested in. And there are so many data pieces that you already have because of what you've been doing.
Madam Chair, and Donna, I apologize because I know we're supposed to hold questions, but I just, could you tell me what you mean by growth model as opposed to, I mean, I'm missing something here, I think.
A growth model is where your states have set their trajectory for getting to the goal. You know, some have 2 years level, then a jump, 2 years level, and it's to get to the goal of proficiency. A growth model would track the trajectory, as long as this is the goal and they're progressing up to it and demonstrating that they are rising to the achievement for the students, that would be a growth model, the individual student tracking.
Okay, so it's on the, it's at the student, the individual student level. Okay, thanks, Madam Chair. I just was afraid I'd really fall behind.
Oh, I'm sorry. If that's okay, believe me, even getting to where we could talk about growth models was huge, because we had, one of our criteria is you have to, in good faith, be moving forward and implementing No Child Left Behind, looking at the children, rising the children, identifying the groups. It can't be your way out. It's your way to serve all children. So that being said, the department is going to rigorously monitor, evaluate states as they receive the pilot, and then monitoring the pilot. I gave you some information on that, and probably more than you necessarily hoped for. But the purpose of the model is this. The department wants to evaluate how these, and that's why the pilots, they have to be watched. Will they do what we're hoping and what the states tell us they will do? These growth models might help schools meet No Child Left Behind in their proficiency goals and the ultimate closing the achievement gap. The second piece is the pilot project will provide the department, us, as well as states, useful information to improve the quality of data, assessment, and accountability systems. Not every, just because it created an accountability system does not mean they can utilize it. It doesn't do you a lot of good to have an accountability system you cannot then utilize to break down and address the needs that the kids have. It'd be like if you're having your house built and three of the four guys were achieving the skill level to set the brick and mortar as the foundation's being poured, and that somebody better be either at this guy's side or pulling him out and giving him the skills so that that whole foundation that you're going to build the house on is well defined and determined. So we're saying it's a different way to get to the prize of achievement, but the ultimate goal is the same. So it will be held to a high standard, but in the process, if we're tracking individual children in the growth model, and we see that all of a sudden they're taking off because they're getting the instruction they need, they're getting the support at home, all the pieces that come together, then we want to be able to say, look what Alaska is doing. These are some of the best practices. They're doing it out in rural, remote, or they're doing it in Fairbanks, or they're doing it in Anchorage, and it is making a difference that you can track. Now, how can you utilize what they're doing and give them the options of the very best practices? So that's pretty much what the growth model is about. I gave you enough paperwork to probably, core principles, what it is, so that you don't have to try to process it. This is how I do it. I go through and I highlight things I need to know, put those stickies on there. Because it is one of those things that can get real policy and bogged down. But the idea is we're all going to get there, and the goal for 2014 is to close that achievement gap for all children. Some may go by ferry, some may go by plane, some may drive, but in the end, we want them all there. So, now we have two more. Higher ed. Ooh, please make your make noise. We now have a national dialogue, which if you don't know about, it's not because I didn't send an email. The Secretary of Education has a commission on the future of higher education. The goal being we have a responsibility, and Alaska has really been on top of this, to make the higher education system relevant to meeting the nation's and students' needs so that they're educated and they're a competitive workforce in the 21st century. The movement between Alaska, Canada, and the Pacific Northwest area and the jobs that flow in between there, if the pipeline goes through, and if some of the things happen that may be coming up in the future, my understanding is we don't have a workforce ready to roll. And what we're saying is, what do we need higher ed to look like? How can we ensure that college is affordable and accessible? And how well are the institutions of higher education preparing our students to compete in the new global economy? So, you've got, in Seattle, I can't believe they're doing it, in Seattle, they are having, it's called a field hearing. That's where it's open forum, written or public comment will be accepted at that forum. It should be on your paperwork. They're gonna have five of the commissioners there. They're doing a higher ed outreach. And input from the public, from those in that, who are interested and have an invested concern for the future past K-12, the input opportunity is there. And right down in Seattle, if you want to do written, I can make sure it gets there. But I would encourage you to contribute to that dialogue. One of the things we're recognizing is the importance of community colleges and vocational technical colleges for serving a large portion of our post-secondary children. Oops, sorry. I call my son a boy, he's 31. The world isn't like it was 30 years ago. We have 30-year-olds going back to college for training. We have actually an 80-year-old just got been graduating from college and a 4-year degree. It's not a done deal. It's not just for kids. It's an ongoing life skill. So we're saying, how do we make it relevant? How do we make it affordable? And how do we partner? And we're looking at business, we're asking business to come to the table, because we're hearing over and over again, the people who come to us after school are not prepared for the world of working. Even if they are brilliant with their ideas, they don't know how to function in a 9-to-5, 8-to-5, whatever world. There's nobody who's gonna write them a note that excuses them because they didn't really feel like going to work today. They need that work ethic, they need the instruction that will prepare them for lifelong learning. And so we're saying, please contribute. And this is one of the opportunities that I'm excited about, and that is having real public input. And so if you have community college people, vote tech people, career development, high school teachers or counselors that you think have valuable insight and information to share on what could make it more meaningful, I really strongly suggest, if they cannot be there in Seattle, to please get their input to me, and I will make sure it gets into the hands of the commission. And the final piece is the Center for Rural Education that we have just established, which is separate from, there's two things. There's the Rural Education Task Force, which has been going on all along. We now have a Center for Rural Education that the secretary has called for facing rural school challenges, how to address them. And the new head has just been named for that, and that's William L. Smith, who was the U.S. Commissioner of Education about 1980. He was the last commissioner before it broke away and went to the Department of Education. And so that rural piece, as you, across the nation, we're looking at 42% of the nation's public schools are in the rural communities or small towns. Well, there are a lot of rural schools out here that are of a different dynamic. And it's an opportunity to ring the bell of people saying, I still get, and I will tell you honestly that I have states on the East Coast who are waiting to see what happens with Alaska and the leeway that is granted to them for their rural education, because by golly, they have rural schools too. And usually, is there a road into it, you know, that you can actually drive on? Do they have phone lines? Do they have power lines? Do they have, let's say a police department, a fire department? Do they have, well, of course they do, but they're 2 or 3 hours away from camp home. I say, let's see. Well, last time I went to a rural one, I got on a Blackhawk in Bethel and headed out because there's no way to get there. And we couldn't fly because the Tundra had done the freeze-off, and the plane was over. So they took the Blackhawk in. And they kind of back up and they go, we don't have, that's just, you're, no. They can't quite believe that rural and wilderness still exists other than in a forest, quote unquote. They also don't know that Alaska isn't covered from head to toe with trees. I mean, it's really interesting, the dynamic. I think they watch National Geographic from there. But rural education as well as urban and suburban are all important pieces. And we have to not have them at war with each other, but rather, how do we meet the needs for the rural school? How do we engage those who are in a tribal or village community so they are also invested in the education piece? Because for a lot of those communities, the school is the focal point. And we want it to be a bridge building thing. And if that means that we need to look at it differently because of the solution, so be it. So I would strongly encourage you to go to the site, pull up names of people who are on that, and start writing them. I have moved forward the importance of having somebody from Alaska involved, and they go, well, we have rural, I think Wyoming covers rural. They think that's the Wild West. And I think it needs to be pushed at the state level that you want somebody engaged.
How do we do that?
I would recommend, one, anything you send to me, I would forward on to the secretary's office. But you could work in partnership with the Department of Ed, with the State Board of Ed. You have a fabulous State Board of Education, too. They have been wonderful to work with and very much on track of keeping the child at the forefront and getting to the goals of closing that achievement gap and finding ways to do it. You're very fortunate. And I know the department has been working on how to qualify TPPs and other issues. And with the strength of the board, and now I'm just going to be leaving and going to a No Child Left Behind conference that the Department of Early Development and Education has put in. They're not ducking the issue. They're trying to find answers, but we've got to not just have Alaska's voice heard in the state. Let's see, I would suggest you let, I can give you and send you if you want, the communication person for William Smith and for Gonzalez, who is on the Rural Commission, so that you can start pressing. It's like anything else. If you hear from one person, you know there are 10 more voices behind it. Hear from the next. But I think I'm going to continue to press the issue, but there is a certain amount of belief system that we've got the basis covered, and I would like to see Alaska stronger represented at that level. So I will also talk to the secretary's lead person and ask their input for the best way to go about that. I know at one time we had moved a couple names forward, and I think there was a problem with availability on their part. I keep trying to tell them Alaska's 4 hours away from the East Coast. They'll call and go, you can't get a hold of anybody. Yeah. They're not on your time zone. Just like they'll call me and think it's the same time zone. Well, aren't you in Washington? The 3 hour Washington. So those are the basic things. A highly qualified teacher, the 2% for special needs, the growth model, the council, the Commission for Higher Ed, please give input on that. And the Center for Rural Education. I need some more water, excuse me. And if you have some questions that I can provide answers for, if not, I will get the answers. Please feel free to ask.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've got several questions. And so, but I'll ask them one at a time, Mr. Chair.
Oh, good. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, feel free to interrupt and go to somebody else, too, because I don't want to dominate this. I'm not sure that I understand the students with disabilities and the cap at 2%.
Mm-hmm.
The way I understood what you had said and the way I read this document that you had provided us, thank you, the students with disabilities are capped at 2% by district? At the district and state level? That's in the first set of bullet points, bullet point number two.
There's an appeal process, but it doesn't exist at this point with the 2%, where the state can petition if a district has more children that need the that have the cognitive issues. The state can petition and demonstrate that they have higher than, it averages up to about 12% of the population where it breaks down for special needs, which more than covers numbers. But if there is an unusual configuration where there are more children in an area, maybe they have the facilities, maybe they have the hospitals. Where I live in Washington State, we have a high concentration surrounding our military bases because we have military hospitals and things. So the state can petition for a greater number because of the data that shows they have more children. But it doesn't necessarily. We aren't at that point with this year.
Mr. Chair, I may have missed something, Donna. I don't understand the 12% of the pot. It says here 2% of the total tested population you're capped at.
Yes.
What's the 12%?
Of all students with special needs.
2%, 12% of 2%?
No. The 2% is the, okay, now we're giving me a headache.
I'm sorry.
Okay, originally when we were talking, this is an expansion. When we were talking about the 1% at the very beginning of No Child Left Behind, there was this exact misunderstanding, which is a large group of educators thought when we said there is room for that set aside for those special needs children because we recognize they have that need, it was 1% of the entire student population that when you look at the national numbers and state numbers that fall in that level of numbers so that it's a match. Essentially, it's a match. Some people thought we were saying 1% of all special needs students rather than all student numbers, and then it was skewed completely off. But the 1% represented more than adequately in general students in special needs population because they're not represented beyond that point.
Mr. Chair, the reason I'm kind of pursuing this is because I know anecdotal information is the worst kind of information possible, but a couple of weeks ago I spent time in one of our middle schools, mm-hmm. and there were far more than 2% special needs students in that school, and so I'm concerned about the cap, and I'm concerned about the flexibility the feds allow a district that has schools with a higher population.
That's where I'm confused. This is for assessing in the progress. The 2% covers those with enough cognitive limitation that they need different assessments, the accommodated assessments or alternative assessments. Not, there are only 2% of the students are special needs. It's of that group that they have enough that they need even more accommodations than they have to be assessed on where they're going and making that progress. It's not, it's the assessment piece, it's not the number.
I don't want to tie this up, so maybe Eddie can get back in touch with
Ms. Chairman.
Yes.
Are you talking about intensive needs students?
Usually cognitive, those are the cognitive.
It's a subset of the disabled. It's a very low percentage of high needs, is what she's talking about.
Okay.
Not the general, what we can generally consider to be 20% of the general population of people needs some assistance as special ed. I think she's talking about the high intensive needs.
Okay.
I appreciate you raising it. Go on, do you have other questions?
I do, but I don't feel like I need to be the only one asking. Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I'm going to talk to you, this is very generic, Donna, and you could, so, which means you've got more latitude to respond however you want. You had made a couple of comments, one with the highly qualified teachers that, you know, think outside the box and make recommendations, and a couple of the things that you suggested, you know, video presentations or satellite kinds of things. And I appreciate that, because I think that we do need to think outside the box. But when you do thinking outside the box like that, or later you were talking about, you know, accessing, you know, how special needs kids sometimes need, you need different points of access, and you use the plane, the highway, the ferry example. I mean, the concern that I have when I hear this are the layered on costs that may be necessary to meet some of the No Child Left Behind kinds of things. And so when you talk about, well, let's talk about, you know, satellite connections. I mean, that may or may not be possible, but there are costs involved in that, or the video presentations. Or, I mean, I agree that we need to reach every student, no matter what their proficiency may be, whether we label them as special needs students or we have other terms for them. I mean, when you build a ferry system plus a highway system plus an airport, you're talking about a lot of money that you need to have to accomplish what you're talking about. And that's one of the frustrations that I have about No Child Left Behind, is the states are given the mandates. We know what the deadlines are, and we know what the potential penalties are, but thinking outside the box can get expensive. And how do you react to that? And I don't mean to say that Alaska is special, but as you've noted, I sometimes get the sense that the Department of Education is going to treat Alaska differently in a bad way. They don't want to crack the door for our rural schools because they know, as you suggested, that East Coast schools that consider themselves rural are going to want to rush through that crack. And that seems to present some difficulties for us.
Thank you, sir. In response, there are about 3 points. There are mandates, definitely, with No Child Left Behind. Almost all of them were under the prior 1994-96 reauthorization that was called Impact Aid. No, not Impact Aid. Do you remember? What was it? The former ESEA.
Yes.
Which is Elementary and Secondary Education Act during President Clinton's time. There were 11 states that were in compliance for their federal dollars to meet the guidelines and the regulations for the money they were given. Most of what we've asked for, including some of these pieces, the money was sent to the states, and we don't know what happened, but those pieces still aren't in place. So this time they put a little more teeth to it, so there are more teeth. For highly qualified teachers, I guess I would consider the cost of not having teachers who are highly qualified in their area delivered to a classroom. It then becomes a reverse penalty that you're penalizing the child where because they live far away rather than finding, yes, it will cost, but to move a teacher out there would be even more expensive. To satellite systems cost money, but there are funds available that with a highly qualified teacher entitled to. It will cost money. Education costs money. I come from all different sides of it, and I do not know yet where money has ever been the true answer. It's going to help. But you can make an awful lot of good with what you have. And if it's paving, I'm not saying do that. I'm saying it hasn't even been proposed. There have been, okay, these are difficult issues. Could somebody please, if this is that difficult and that costly, show us how you can do it, have it less costly, and still deliver the requirements? Because if you're going to get Title I funds, the requirement is you're going to have a highly qualified teacher for that support.
Well, just a comment, you don't need to respond to this, Donna, because it's going to sound argumentative, and I don't mean it to sound that way, but quite frankly, I'm thinking more and more that the Utah solution, I think it's Utah, may be the best way to go, because a federal recipe that you try to apply universally ends up hurting in Alaska, for reasons that you've already spoken to.
The only thing I would respond to that, sir, is that Alaska already had their standards and their rules in place and their guidelines, and if anything, when the AYPs have come out, data of early progress, they have showed that Alaska is farther along than they expected to be by their own standards. And we're, if anything, strengthening the standards that Alaska had in place and helping accelerate. There's more dollars that came into Alaska. Now, there aren't as many this year, but those dollars do assist in achieving basically the standards and the principles that Alaska has set for their students have been enhanced and should be strengthened by the dollars that came in federally. There is not a great deal of conflict. Alaska has its part. We expect students to know this. I believe there's also discussion on an, and I hope this isn't a bad conversation, on an exit exam and some other things that we hear around the country. Alaska had a good bar set for itself, and now in combination with local districts, the State Department, the State Board of Ed, and some technical assistance that we've got, they're well on the way to being there. So it is costly, but I guess I can't think of one child, whether they're in a rural or suburban or urban area, that isn't deserving of the best education that can be delivered through dollars available.
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with that.
Sure.
But I think that one of the things that really, really bothers me is you have said that Alaska is well ahead, and yet Alaskans find it sometimes very frustrating that you don't give us the latitudes to keep moving forward with local district, local municipality, and state initiatives. What you have done instead is created an awful lot of time and energy that needs to be directed to, for example, the highly qualified teacher thing. It doesn't help us. And if in fact you think we're doing a pretty good job, I mean, the additional federal requirements are a drain on resources, and they may not fit for us. And so, I just bridle a little bit when somebody tells me to think outside the box because the feds have a mandate on how we have to accomplish that.
I can certainly respect that. I would say that your U.S. senators and representatives are the ones who have created the law. The department's job is enforcing. And again, I have several pages of what your state and local decisions are under No Child Left Behind, and I would be happy to send those to you, because the bulk of the decisions, including your state standards, how you qualify a highly qualified teacher, each state sets their standard for teacher certification, the house plan, which is a highly objective uniform state, oh great, I can't remember my own acronyms, but the state can set its own separate standards for how a teacher hits highly qualified. They don't have to necessarily follow the academic path that has been the tradition. They can create, and they have created, alternative routes and are working on that. So each state has set that differently, and Alaska is free to do so. They've proposed the video conference, or videotaping, excuse me, as well as assessing by a test to demonstrate that what they are teaching, they have core knowledge of, and that they can demonstrate it in the classroom to the kids. And if they are teaching it, it shouldn't be that hard to demonstrate that they are qualified to do so. So there are alternative routes to demonstrating that also. And so that aligns with the state making the decision, and I know the state board has been working on that too. But I would be happy to send you, just for your own information, what the decisions are that are state decisions, local decisions, and where the federal piece is, so that at least you know if it's a federal thing or if it's state-driven or if it's locally driven, so that it could be real clear on where the focus needs to be, because some things are definitely driven federally and some are driven. Some of the states have actually worked on some of their laws because our regulations were more lenient than theirs were, and they wanted to loosen some of the flexibility to take those options. So I would try, be happy to provide that if you would like, and then follow up.
I would like.
Thank you, sir.
Other questions?
Well, I just a little bit more about the Commission on Higher Education. Donna, I guess the second bullet point on the fact sheet that you distributed, how well are institutions of higher education preparing our students to compete in the new global economy? I don't want to sound more conservative than I am. Well, some of my colleagues would say that would be difficult. But it just...
You are sitting on my right.
I am. Kind of your far right. Donna, I guess my reaction when I see something like that, and when I see, a goal like that is, I think we have an awful lot of diversity in our post-K-12 education system. Unfortunately, Alaska doesn't have enough, but, I mean, part of that's based on our population. But we've got private institutions, we've got public institutions, we've got several different kinds of levels, whether it's community colleges or two-year diplomas in the voc ed field. There are a lot of opportunities, whether it's with a labor union and an apprenticeship program or a hands-on at Kotzebue Tech Center. We have an awful lot of that, and I don't want to play loose with the term a diverse and free market when it comes to higher education, but I mean, especially given, and I think you can understand where I'm coming from maybe on No Child Left Behind, but especially given that, I don't know that I understand what the federal role is in directing this diverse group of post-K-12 institutions on how they best prepare their students to compete in the new global economy. It seems to me that that's a choice that a student or the student's parents will make. If they want to go to Georgetown and get a degree in foreign diplomacy, they have that opportunity. If they want to become an electrical engineer, they have that opportunity. What that goal is for this commission?
Over 80% of our public universities, colleges, and community colleges funding comes from federal government. Unlike K-12, the vast majority of dollars that keep our institutions of public higher ed going are federal dollars. We are getting feedback from the business community, from those who are graduating, from those. Actually, I get an amazing number of calls for post-secondary issues saying, I went through, I was guaranteed that when I graduated with this degree, I would be ready to move into the workforce, and I am not prepared. They tell me I don't have what it takes to come into the workforce or into the career I was hoping to go into. So what we're saying is, if that needs being vocalized, and we hear it from the business community, one of the best responders we have right now to that with the easiest amount of turnaround time have been our community colleges, Voc Tech, because they have 30-year-olds coming in, or they have kids who say, I may not make it for 4 years, but I want to get an associate's degree. A lot of times then they go on to further education. But they can they have a quickness of response so that when the economy changes and jobs change directions on the need, that they can accommodate quicker. What we're saying, okay, if that's true, how can we do this across the board? If our dollars, which are your tax dollars and my tax dollars, are going to fund a large portion of higher ed, are we using that money for those people who are taking advantage of their educational opportunities, to equip them with what they need. Preparing a teacher the way a teacher was prepared to enter the classroom 30 years ago is not adequate. We have to recognize the student demographics. We are not, we used to be an agri, not in the lower 48, the lower 48 used to be agricultural. Then we went industrial. Then we went high tech. Yet we still operate under the agriculture society in how we educate and how the days of school, everything else. What we're saying is we need to look at what the real world is. The world is flat, Thomas Friedman. And we are dealing with higher competition from the outside world.
Donna?
Sorry.
I don't mean to be rude, but you're kind of preaching to the choir.
Oh, sorry.
And
not necessarily.
More than necessarily, no. He wanted to know why federal government is getting involved in higher education. I think your answer is it's federal dollars.
Yep.
Some evidence it's they're not on target.
Yep.
Some possibility they can learn from others who are doing it far better.
What
Plus what?
Said, yes, sir. Thank you. Yeah, I forgot. But essentially, because a huge amount of federal dollars going in there, we want more accountability that the students are getting the quality of education that those dollars are going toward.
Just an analogy. I mean, in our state, most of our schools are funded with public dollars. Our K through 12 schools are funded with public dollars. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm in favor of state mandates for local school districts, where I think as many decisions ought to be left to the local school board as possible. So, I mean, there are different ways of handling this. There are guidance ways where you can suggest that maybe you ought to think about doing this. Or there are the mandated ways, which is part of the problem I have with No Child Left Behind. And I guess my concern is that you're now shifting the same kind of attentions that our K through 12 schools have gotten to the post-secondary or education system.
And I would just say that this right now is a dialogue. It's not unlike when Sputnik went in, and we had to recognize that we need to scramble if we were going to stay in the lead. We're saying we better look and see if we're going to need to scramble. And if we are, how do we come together? Congress will make decisions regardless. What we want to do is at least be able to bring them the information from business, from those invested in this piece. Out in Alaska, out in Washington, out in Nebraska, and say, this is the similarity of messages. Can we recognize that this is an area of need?
You probably
can't legislate it.
Mr. Chair, Donna, you probably don't need to worry about my views on this, because my comments today have virtually guaranteed I probably won't be selected as a state's representative of this commission. So.
You're asking some of the great questions.
That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions? Any other things you want to cover with us?
Just thank you for letting me speak to you. If there are ever questions that I can assist you with the answers on, or if you would like somebody to come in for testimony, I can always see if we can bring somebody in to address those. But Alaska is doing some wonderful things. I have deep roots in Alaska. I'm very proud that my roots are here. And I truly believe that Alaskans can do this. They can succeed for every child. You're in God's country.
You got that right. Thank you very much, not only for coming here, but visiting our rural communities and what you've committed to understanding that and helping the rest of the nation understand our uniqueness. Don't give up.
Thanks.
We're adjourned.